This is Christopher Hawk, turning on and tuning out, technology and psychotherapy, April 25th, 2008. This is the audio track from a DVD. The DVD is available in the library at the Jung Society.
Christopher Hawk is an IAAP Jungian analyst in private practice in central London and a lecturer at Goldsmith College, University of London. He's fascinated by the interface between individuals and their collective culture, especially creative, unconscious processes in movie making. Christopher is also a filmmaker, a regular speaker on BBC Radio, and lectures widely in the USA, UK, and Europe. Chris's latest book is Human Being Human, Culture and the Soul. Previous books include Jung and the Postmodern, the Interpretation of Realities, and he's edited several books, including Jung and Film, a post-Jungian takes on the moving image, and Contemporary Jungian Analysis, Post-Jungian Perspectives from the Society of Analytical Psychology. So, welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Thanks very much indeed. Well, it is great to be back. I mean, talking about technology, I mean, 5 years ago, everything was on tape. It was still all on tape. I had made all my tapes up, and I'd got them transferred to NTSC, you know, your regional thing, you know, down in Soho, London, at great expense, I remember. But everything worked, and it all was good. But now I've had to source Region 1 DVDs here, and I've just joined a DVD club in Seattle, you know, for two nights. Borrowed four films for Unity clips of. So, you know, times change all the time. So this talk's called Turning On and Tuning Out. And it's mainly about, you know, how some of the new technologies have impacted on us as therapists and counsellors and analysts. And I'll spend a little time talking about that. But in the end, I want to focus down on one of my favourite themes, which is an example of new technologies, in that, you know, film images on DVD and everything are so available that people are actually bringing an awful lot of them to therapy now. And I think in America you appreciate this a lot more and have a handle on it. In Britain it's a different game, and I'll go into that. And maybe we'll talk even more about that tomorrow, how people can be very, purist about this, whether this is the material of therapy or not. We can talk about that. But let's start with talking about technology and therapy. In the 50s, do you know D.W.W. Winnicott? You know, the psychoanalyst and pediatrician? Yeah. Now, his lectures about the psychodynamics of mothers and families and children were broadcast to an audience of millions on the home service of the BBC. And during the war, radio, as we know, had grown as a tool of propaganda, but this was the first time it had been used for psychotherapeutic propaganda. And Winnicott's radio broadcasts have much in common with the newer communication technologies that, in their implications for psychotherapy and counselling, I think. For one, the technology provides a form of communication accessible to just about everyone without discrimination. The drawback of such accessibility, though, is the failure to take account of individual differences, only possible in the one-on-one encounter. And another factor that the new technologies have in common with radio, which was an old new technology, is the speed in which the message reaches the listeners. And yet, despite these drawbacks, fast mass communications, the technologies of television and radio, and now the internet, cellular phones, have been generally welcomed as beneficial. So I begin today with a focus on these technologies of communication, which feature in our daily lives and impact upon our work as therapists and counsellors. And in doing so, I emphasise the importance of being consciously aware of how these technologies, email, the internet, cell phones, SMS texting, and so on, generate fantasies about human communication. While appearing to offer clarity and speed and access, communication technologies can generate omnipotent demands, which human users find hard to meet. And if we're not careful, you know, if we're not careful with our expectations when it comes to these technologies, the fantasy of contact can lead to interpersonal projections and distortions unintended by the users. But secondly, as I promised, I focus on the positive application of new media in psychotherapy, and this is the use of movies and their images and stories in the therapy session. And I argue the case that the movie images, though not traditionally regarded as material of clinical work, are as useful and important as any communication the client brings. Like dreams and other narratives, movies can express and uncover aspects of ourselves and contribute deeply to self-knowledge and individuation. But it's good to talk, isn't it? Alexander Graham Bell had great faith in his invention, the telephone. Soon, he predicted, every town in America will have one of these. And Bill Gates, your own Bill Gates, said he could see the day when there would be a Windows PC in every home in the country. Well, they both underestimated. In my household alone, there are 6 operating phones, 5 cells, 1 landline with 2 wireless extensions and ADSL broadband, and I'm not a rich man. And we run 5 separate computers with more gigabytes of hard drive memory than it took to take the men to the moon. A lot more. And the computers are far bigger as well. You know, they went to the moon on 386s, didn't they? Or 486s. As aids to communication between individuals, telephones, cell phones and internet messaging appear to offer benefits to therapists and clients as much as the general population. But the way that all these technologies make it possible to communicate without the physical presence of the other person may be more important for the therapist-client pair to pay attention to than other relationships in the culture. It may be desirable to conduct telephone sessions from time to time, and I know many of you do. I mean, many of you live a lot of distances from your clients and or from your analysts sometimes. So it may be desirable, but they may have considerable power to hold the client in the work. But equally, they may fail to achieve what a face-to-face meeting can. And so I think more thought needs to be given to what's missing in the phone session rather than assuming it's more or less an equivalent form of work or dialogue. But while a phone conversation is at least happening in the here and now, in real time, with text messaging and voicemail, it's possible to leave minutes or hours or even days between each side of a dialogue. And I heard, when I originally wrote this, I heard that the week ending November the 2nd, 2007, that's last fall, in Britain alone, that was the week when we sent over 1 billion texts in 1 week. They topped 1 billion. Now, SMS, as you know, text, stands for short message service, and therein lies the limitation. Texts, and I don't know about you, but a lot of patients text me, and Well, I can't reply at any length. Of course I can't. This is a short message service. But they text at length, like my children do often. Texts force us to compress a communication into fewer words, shortened words and less grammatical structures, so that the nuance of the spoken word, which elsewhere can be enhanced by writing, in the case of texting, gets distorted or lost. And texting, with its speed of transfer and brevity of style, poses as if it's just like speech, immediate and direct. But in fact, texts fail to achieve anything near the value and clarity of speech, making them a form of communication prone to misunderstanding and confused messages with less chance of correction and clarification than the spoken word. Asking a text message, say, more than the straightforward, sorry, train late today, see you at 10, with late, L8, and a 2, and a day, and a C, and a U, all that shorthand. Any more than that is asking it to do too much. So, really, my theme about these forms of communication is that they promote a fantasy of contact, which often leads to disappointment and failure and projections of all sorts of unintended motivations on the part of either the sender or the receiver or both. The ubiquity of the mobile cell phone has not only led to greater use of phone communication, but also seems to have made us forgetful of the limitations of the technology, of how much we can actually say, hear, or understand between ourselves and others when we're using it. Not so long ago, I knew of therapists who wouldn't have an answer phone in that, maybe this was 15, 20 years ago, in that they thought that was too impersonal. They would rather let the phone ring. Oh well. Nowadays, when in a rush, we expect and prefer to leave a voicemail rather than have a conversation. And ironically, we feel robbed of the chance not to talk when they pick up the phone and answer. We've all been there. We're so used to needing that. And this is why we text sometimes as well, because we'd rather not speak to the person. We want to communicate something. We don't want to reply. And we've all seen how folk go round. I don't know if it's... I haven't seen it so much here, but certainly in London and in Britain. Folk go round clutching the mobile phone or play with it dreamily or check it frequently. And when seated, they put it over there like it's another person when they're on their own, you know, waiting for action. It's true. And my 18-year-old son, he confessed that he felt vulnerable when leaving home without his mobile. And this isn't because he wants to ring 911 or 999 in Britain. It's just because he wants to be in touch with everyone. There's clearly some fantasy going on here, and I think it's this fantasy of contact. And it's linked to the need for attachment, proximity, and even intimacy with another. And it's a technical tool which can collapse the miles that separate us and bring us together in a warm fantasy of contact. That's why the unreturned text or voicemail or switch to busy when you ring someone can all carry strong feelings of disappointment and letdown. They feel like refusals to be close. They're like a cold shoulder, a turning away in the fantasy of contact that's being pursued by the caller or texter. Because the speed and immediacy of contact is technically possible, the refusal of the call by its human operator carries greater valency. On the other hand, the failure of the signal, a failure of the technology itself causing a communication breakdown, well, that can provide an experience that can be shared by both parties and can bring them together in commiseration. Sorry, I went through a tunnel. But a trick also many have learned when they want to is to disguise their wish to end the call, and that's to pretend the signal has failed so you can't hear them. Now, that is a human technology interface in action. Now, I'd like to move on to something that you might have come across in therapy, and that's the use of computers. I don't know about here, but in Britain, they are trying to promote and starting to use certain forms of diagnostic computer interface action. At the moment, it's with the general practitioner. He will ask the questions and sort of mark them on the computer. But it's coming that the client or the patient will actually sit down at the screen and go through some sort of CBT type of routine with a computer program. And this started a long, long time ago, lots of experiments with that. It's very easy to be fooled by words and silence, as we all know. And researchers in artificial intelligence have long pondered the ability of a computer to understand and think like a human mind. You might have heard something called the Turing test, which offers the situation where a questioner gets answers from a hidden communicator and has to tell whether the answers are coming from a human or from a machine. And when we get an automated message on our phones or computer, it reads like a human being is informing us. Some even have, as you know, a recorded human voice, and sometimes it's a very nice voice and very friendly voice. But it is still really only an impersonal machine message with, you know, samples of speech on it. And there have been computer programs that simulate the dialogue of psychotherapy. In the 1970s, a guy called Joseph Weizenbaum wrote a computer program called ELIZA. I can't remember what the acronym stands for. Many of you must have heard of her. ELIZA. Which simulated the responses of a psychotherapist in conversation. Now, it's of the mirroring type of response, okay, that some therapists use. It's psychotherapy 101, isn't it? And it allows the program, according to Sherry Turkle, to make an acceptable response without knowing the meaning of what's been said. Something us therapists might wish to ponder. So here's an example of a dialogue between a client and such a program designed to respond to keywords in the client's discourse. It's between a woman client and the computer. I'll start off with the woman. The woman says, "My boyfriend made me come here." The computer says, "Your boyfriend made you come here? He noticed I'm depressed most of the time. I'm sorry to hear you're depressed." "He's right. I am unhappy." "Do you think coming here will make you not be unhappy?" "I need some help, that much is clear." "What would it mean to you if you got some help?" "Well, perhaps I could learn to get along with my mother." "Tell me more about your family." "My mother takes care of me." Who else in your family takes care of you? My father. Your father? You are like my father in some ways. What resemblance do you see? You're not very aggressive. What makes you think I'm not very aggressive? You don't argue with me. Why do you think I don't argue with you? You're afraid of me. Does it please you to believe I'm afraid of you? It pleases my father to think I'm afraid of him. What else comes to mind when you think of your father? And so it goes on. It's a real conversation. And Eliza could also be coaxed into sounding more lifelike if you really pressed her. So here's the person. The person says, "You are not a person." Eliza says, "Why do you say I'm not a person?" "Because you are not." "Are you telling me that because I am not?" "No. Why are you being so negative?" The Eliza program achieves this by using a rule that says if the person uses the words "no" or "not" more than three times in a row, it'll accuse you of being negative. I expect we do that sometimes. So. And a young male geek once hacked into a computer of a girl he fancied with an Eliza-type program. You know, this is a virus to watch out for. And every time she called up a file, you know, like a Word file or anything, like letters doc or something, it would ask, "Tell me more about what you feel about letters doc." And then when the student went to the help menu, all she got back was, "Why do you feel you need help?" This is a hacked Eliza program. And these days, of course, I'm sure you have several clients like I have now and have had in the past who are into all sorts of internet communication, you know, to find a partner and stuff like that. But it's possible these days for two people to have a relationship and have it stimulated and reinforced and become intimate and lead to feelings of love and then promises of marriage through internet dating without them ever meeting at all in the flesh. And the excitement of love at the emotional, psychological, and physiological level can proceed in two separate bodies thousands of miles apart. And short of that, though much excitement and other emotions are stimulated electronically through contacts made on, there's a thing in Britain called Friends Reunited, and then MySpace and Facebook, of course. And we all know of encounters and further intimacy arranged through these websites, which have led to regret when it comes to the physical reality of such meetings. And what's far worse, of course, is when predatory males pose as younger or more innocently motivated than they really are to lure their victims, a deception that digital and internet technology facilitates with ease. But, you know, the big one, what about email communication? Are emails not the same thing as a handwritten or a typed letter? Well, I think the speed of email robs us of the thinking time that finding a pen and paper, taking care to write legibly or typing, folding it into an envelope, getting a stamp from somewhere, walking to the postbox. It's all thinking time. You can think again about what you've written. You can pause. You can say, "Oh, I wish I'd said that better," and go back. But when you press that send button, it's just gone. There's no time to correct it. And many, many mistakes have happened like that. Like other examples of precise, fast technical aids to communication, the speed and precision of email are the very qualities that can also undermine what it does for us. Along with this difficulty, an etiquette of reply has developed around electronic mail communications, like with texts. I think the expectation, on average probably, is that an acknowledgement, if not a full reply, will be returned within 24 to 36 hours. And if you're not into that, people will think you're rude. People will think there's something wrong with what they said. People will think that this delay means something because this etiquette is somehow built up. And we can even send, of course, along with our email, an automated response request for the recipient to say they got the mail before replying even with a message of their own. And ignoring this request itself, let alone not replying to the email, can send an unwritten message of rejection, rightly or wrongly. When your letter is on the other side of the world a second after you press send, email is so fast that we expect a similar speed of reply from the human being at the other end. But humans have not got upgraded that quick. We have not become dual core processor people. We're operating with the same memory and processing speed we had 250,000 years ago. And many social demands and expectations are similar to those of 1,000 years ago, when talking to each other face to face was just about the only way you could get a message across, due to, you know, widespread illiteracy. No one read or wrote in those days. We should remember we've only been literate, generally, the last 120 years. The technology of word communications and the email, I think, needs to be consciously attended to and discriminately applied to our personal needs and wishes, rather than enslave us with its technical facility. And, you know, you're talking about psychodynamics. The amount of psychodynamics people talk about with their family and their colleagues that arises through email communications and misunderstandings is really quite a lot. You probably found some yourself. Sometimes a response to the way that new technologies have speeded up our lives comes in the form of the new technologies themselves. Meaning, after the invention of photography, you know, about the 40s and 1840s, 50s and so on, the arrival of movie films offered the late 19th century urban population of Europe and America a grasp on life that had become increasingly confusing and out of control. And I'm really talking about urban life here, because that includes the fact that many people had moved from the countryside to the urban centres, and everything was changing very fast. We're talking about 1895 now. By 1895, electric light and trams, railway trains and the telegraph and colour print advertising, street lighting and the motor car were making city life faster and more alienating than in any previous era. Human beings barely had time to catch up. And the new technology of movies became available to the public at the same time as did the new psychodynamic way of thinking. And in 1895, the Lumiere brothers were showing films in this the basement of a Paris cafe to a couple of hundred people at a time, thousands a day. And Freud was talking about, I think he was giving his first paper on childhood seduction to the psychiatrist in Vienna about 1895. Both of these, I think, served to frame the experience of a frighteningly new, accelerated and perplexing human urban life. And in comparable ways, and very different ways, but in comparable ways, they both offered strategies to cope with it. It's to do with framing up experience and giving it a frame. That's the theme. I'll come back to this in a minute. So let's go back a minute and just think about psychotherapy and, you know, what is deemed, and it's different for you and it's different for other audiences I've spoken to, deemed as proper material. What is the stuff of therapy? There's always been a discussion about what's acceptable for a client to bring to a psychotherapy session. There's letters that a client might want to show us, or a poem he's written to his mother, or a painting he thinks conveys something he was feeling last night. All of these, you know, they come in. What about photographs? Do we allow ourselves to receive and view old snapshots of the family? What if the pictures are on the laptop the client brings? What if she lets us know she's improved some of these images in Adobe Photoshop? If we decide to look at all, do we really know what we're looking at? Does it matter? I recently heard of one therapist who refused the request to look at her client's family photos, and these were the old paper photos sort, because she was determined to keep the analytic frame as she saw it. So I assume that her version of the analytic exchange restricts patients solely to the spoken word, and silence too, presumably, and descriptions, but no objects are allowed, only internal objects, and maybe one object, the check at the end of the month. But also, speaking of checks, a supervisee of mine received his first request from a client to play by electronic bank transfer. And we had to talk about this. It was new to this this trainee. It wasn't new to me, but really it's surprising how few people do pay by electronic transfer. I've only had one in all my time. And I don't mind if they want to. But there was something about the contact with the client that it was... We felt he should discuss this with the client. There's something about the physical transfer of that that check and that bill that is sometimes important, and it was a bit more important even in that case. And given what I've said already about email and everything, should we let clients email us as freely as writing letters? Should we receive and read either of these? Many analysts don't. They just won't look at them. Or leave them unread and just ask about them in the session. And then what about voicemail or text messages? I've got no answers to these. We all do our different preferences. And I think few of us are so strict as to not accept any of these, I imagine. There can hardly be a therapist here who hasn't viewed a photograph or a piece of writing or a drawing, certainly. Jungians, anyway. A patient hands us in an effort to understand and be understood and understand themselves better. And we might vary between clients as to what we think is right and what we think is, you know, being defensive or resistant behaviour or something. The typewritten poem, you see, may be a resistance topic, tactic, postponing talking about the material in the session because it would be too painful. On the other hand, the patient who finds it hard to articulate their feelings, they might actually only be able to give a picture or a poem or some writing in the meantime. And I've found both cases, and everything in between. So, going back to movies, really this is scene setting for the fact that when people bring movie images, and the ways they bring them, I think is a valid contribution and a valid source of material to bring to a therapy session. And so I think it's a positive use of this technology. With the availability of cheap optical media, DVD and CD, popular culture and visual and sound tech recording are more predominant in people's these days in their lives than literature and the plastic arts, I think. Photographic media so dominates our culture that clients these days are more likely to mention a movie as a painting or as a book or certainly as a poem. References are made to images and scenes from movies, to movie stories and movie characters, and relationships. They're quite common in my practice. And while we know movies themselves may vary in quality, they are popular because they impact emotionally and mean different things to many different people. Movies can be surprising in their ability to stir and transport thoughts and emotions and move the viewer to change or transcend their lives. I remember when I was 16, I saw Midnight Cowboy and Easy Rider in the same afternoon, walking between two cinemas. And you know, I was so bowled over by those, and they really inspired my my themes of actually not taking the status quo for granted, I think, and actually questioning all that. I was only 16. But a patient of mine recently, a young man, he had a very poor experience on acid at some festival or something like that. And he was, that was okay, and he's fine and sort of recovered, but he's been left with one of these dreadfully anxious states that he calls panic attacks, but it's just an ongoing anxiety. And to describe it to me, the main impact of his main experience was, he said, "I felt I was in the Truman Show." And I immediately understood what he was talking about because, you know, the Truman Show has become what could we say? It's become a sort of a very live metaphor for that whole sort of paranoid state that before was carried by, you know, people speaking out of TVs or thinking that that the communications were coming from the radio directed totally to you, all those ideas of reference. And the Truman Show really depicted that world in a way that someone can come to me and get across a whole wealth of experience and anxiety and fear. And I think we're talking about Truman Show after he knows. That you know, gives us a basis for starting the work. So I thought I'd start off by showing you a little clip from that really gets across these sort of points. Now, this is when Truman has met the girl, or he's remembered meeting the girl on the beach, and she told him that things weren't all kosher in his world. And something goes wrong with the technology where he lives, and he starts realising that the world is not as it seems. Here we go.
It's another beautiful day in paradise for Crypto. Yep. Buckle up out there in Radio Land. Good driver.
Great, isn't it? Yeah. And you know, that is going to be rather typical of the illustration I'm showing you. You realise that was all done without dialogue. There's no dialogue there at all. And the ability of film to show without having to tell is very, very important, I think. The way that the pictures and the people and their actions, they do the telling of the story without words, which is strange, really, given that we're in the business of words and word communication so much. But I want to show you something from back in the old days, the very first days of film. This is going to be something from the Lumiere brothers, and they made these films with hot titles like Workers Leaving the Factory, Feeding the Baby. And these are little one-minute shorts because they couldn't, you know, make enough film in the right way to fit in their cameras. But Lumiere brothers, they invented colour photography and they invented the movie camera. And the thing is, them and their copyists in Britain, they recently found all these films in Britain, Mitchell and Kenyon films, and I'm sure the Lumiere brothers did the same. They'd go out and they'd film the population in the streets, and then they'd show themselves in the village halls. And that's how they'd make their money. People would come in and see themselves. And this is like 1895 for the Lumiere brothers, and going right through to 1900, 1905, 1910. They hadn't thought yet of actually making dramas or anything like that. It was just a simple sort of reality movies for folk to really enjoy seeing their lives framed up there on the screen. And there's something about that that, I don't know, do you know the analyst Pat Berry? Some of you must know her. But she's got an article in a chapter in Jung and Film. And she reckons, she examines this context in the context of the speeded up and chaotic urban industrial life I was talking about. And she said, working in the factory is one thing, as she says. Watching it framed in the cinema, the experience of watching it, not the doing of it, is another. Watching the film version is a way of getting the reality back, regaining an experience of the world, retrieving it from this machine-driven life of railways, electric lights, and advertising hoardings. And Henry Ford's conveyor belt factory. Movies helped frame life for the viewer. We're nearly there now, so I'll just pause it. Yeah, I'll just finish this. Yeah, movies helped frame life for the viewer. Turn it into art, into something they could take in, reflect upon, and restore to themselves. Just as psychotherapy enables reflection, consciousness, and getting back a life that might otherwise slip away unconsciously and wastefully into the shadows, cinema was the framing of reality. People needed to live it and more consciously know it. I wonder, let's watch this with the sound down because it's got a commentator on it. But otherwise, there are three of the Workers Leaving the Factory films in sequence.
And all the other days, it was raining. The only sunny day is March 11. So at 11 and 3, they shoot the first film. The history of invention stopped there. History of invention. Of March 1890. We are Chemin Saint-Victor in front of the Lumiere Factory. Lumiere puts his camera in front of the factory and begs, orders, this is the first film. The first version, we know it because the journalist of the time described a bicycle, a dog, and a horse. The workers, mostly women, know they are filmed because they are not looking at the camera. Another version, shot maybe later on in the spring or in the fall, they are dressed in a different way and they are becoming the first character of the first cinematograph film. The first character means the crowd, the working class. I think it's very moving.
He is completely ignoring the fact that people then would go and pay to watch themselves. He's not commenting on that, which other commentators do. But this is the famous one.
And it's clearly shot in the summer. The workers are dressed more likely. The dog and the bicycle coming out.
Love the dog. Keep the dog. Start of Disney.
On the street, on the pavement.
Okay, thanks. Right. So there was something very fascinating for people who, you know, for it to go on for so long, this business of pouring in to watch themselves framed up like this. And, you know, the way that cinema has been so important since for city populations, and it's given us so much back, is something to do with the way it frames and delivers back reality to us in a certain way. But what I'm going to do now, you said you wanted a break, so I'm going to go on for another sort of 5 or 6 minutes and show another clip, and I think that will make quite a natural break. And then how long should we have after that as a break?
Just take 10 minutes.
10 minutes, yeah, to have a breather, and then I'll finish off with the final half hour or whatever it is, yeah. So, to finish this section, when a client brings a psychotherapist an image from a movie, there are several possibilities, aren't there? It may be a movie the therapist is familiar with, or one that he or she doesn't know at all. So should the therapist at some time then go and see it? If they don't know it, other way around, if a therapist thinks of a movie image that will be helpful to the client, should he let the client know? If the client has seen it, they might talk about it there and then. If the client hasn't, then they might go away and just see what the therapist was talking about. I've talked about this quite a lot in America and Britain, and I had a good long conversation with New York analysts. And one analyst there, it was a trainee, he said he was inspired to recommend the film Fight Club to a client. Now, his intention was to help the patient have some insight into a tendency towards a dissociated, aggressive masculinity. The analyst worried later that he had been too hasty and he'd perhaps imposed an image, a way of seeing the issue, without waiting for the client to arrive at and express his own understandings. Hadn't been patient enough. The movie image in that case had too succinctly and prematurely framed the topic at hand. But a bigger problem with any sharing of movies seen by therapist and client is that neither have seen the same movie. They may have looked at the same movie, but the film is such a highly subjective experience, it's unlikely they will have got the same meaning, affect, or understanding from it, from what they've seen. Every time I bring this up now, that it seems people agree with me, I won't get the same feeling, affect, or understanding from one year to the next if I watch a film. Isn't it surprising how it really tracks where we're at, either the occasion we're at or where we're at in a more general sense in our own development or individuation? The experience of seeing a film is not the same thing as what the film is all about. In spite of the filmmaker's intentions, movies provoke widely varying responses. And these generate different meanings for different people, and as I said, same for the same person, different meanings at different times. Alan Jones, a Jungian analyst in New York, he told me that after seeing the film On Golden Pond, with Katharine Hepburn, Henry Fonda, and Jane Fonda, one person said it was about an older couple at the end of their life, another person said it's about a daughter's relationship with her father, and the third one said it's a story about a little boy. Well, I don't remember the little boy. Is there a little boy? I suppose there is, but you wouldn't think it was the central bit. Oh, someone said about Chinatown that it was a vampire movie. That was in Zurich. It had the vampire movie sense to Chinatown. I couldn't see it, but this is how she took it. Jung didn't see many movies, didn't say a lot about movies, but he did say that the cinema, he said, like the detective story, enables us to experience without danger to ourselves all the excitements, passions, and fantasies which have to be repressed in a humanistic age. And I think what he means by that humanistic age thing is that we don't go and see gladiators fight, but we can see Gladiator as it's made for us up on the screen. And a patient of mine, in fact, you know, people in London, analysts were aghast at this, but see what you think. A patient of mine once brought his laptop in to show me a scene on a DVD, which he'd been talking about before. Maybe he thought I just didn't get it. But he brought it in, and it conveyed some quintessence of anguished feeling that he was having. And I watched the scene, and it didn't have the same meaning for me at all. But, we used it as a basis to talk about what he meant and what he was feeling, which I thought was fair enough. And I think...
Why were they aghast?
Oh, don't know. We'll talk about that later. We can wonder. But I think it was important to him he had brought the experience to me and seen me witness it. It's a bit like, you know, telling a dream. This is where it comes very similar to the dream. It's a bit like telling a dream and knowing that the person's hearing it. It strikes me how the immediacy of that film material is comparable to the dream the patient brings. The film provides, in some way, the possibility of a closer participation. Because we don't experience our patient's dreams, and we don't witness them. We report of the dream from the patient, of course. In a similar way, a client's description of a movie scene or a story or character is a stimulus for the imagination and understanding of the therapist. Watching the movie might be more so. It might not. Movie scenes are as able to unfold unconscious contents sometimes and stir affects just as a dream or transference events do. The therapist will have their own personal associations which might be useful or they might be a hindrance. But the therapist's subjective reaction to a patient's dream can also be a helpful or a hindrance in interrupting. And the image shouldn't be taken too literally. And as with everything the client might bring, the therapist's own subjective response needs to be kept in reserve as he listens out for where the client's really at. So I'll show you one more clip now, and we'll take a break after this, because you might want a break after seeing this. This is from a film called Birth that I was involved with. In fact, I've just been staying with the producer. Myself and my wife were up in Canada where he lives now. And this is a film about Nicole Kidman film. Jonathan Glazer directed it, about a woman who lost her husband 10 years before, and she's just about to get remarried, and a little boy, 10-year-old boy, turns up on her doorstep and says, "I'm Sean, I'm your dead husband." Problemo. And so what does that do? You know, it could be a little sci-fi, spooky movie, but it's not. It's a very moving movie about bereavement and what you managed to achieve for yourself. Now, I'm going to show you the very final scene. Again, there's hardly any dialogue at all. And this is where she actually has got married. This is just after the wedding. And it's the very final sequence of the movie. A lot of people haven't seen this. Many of you? No? Haven't seen it or heard of it? It'll be an art house classic one day, I'm sure. I like it very much. Okay, thank you. Yes, long before.
I guess I'll see you in another lifetime.
Okay, let's take a break. I've had a couple of nice conversations in the break there, and really I want to clear up some of the things I'm saying that have happened to me when I've given this talk. I mean, one thing, at the same time as people were aghast that a patient brought in a movie image on a DVD and played it to me, and I actually paid attention to it and watched it with them, as though this happens all the time. This is just a total one-off. And the people in the audience who are SAP analysts said, what are you doing? What are you doing? What's the work about? I mean, what are you up to? That was the phrase, what are you up to? And they also, I also played that at the end, that sequence and birth, to just remind them how powerful film images are. You know, and one day someone might actually draw their attention to that and say that made them feel a certain thing, and it's got lots of Jungian stuff there. There's a shoreline, there's a sea and land, there's a man and woman, and you know, it's full of it, full of it. And so that's a hell of an image. But also, it's a very, very, very moving image. And I think if you haven't seen that a lot, it might have touched your heart. One person in the audience, one of these anti this idea people, said, "Yes, well, I was angry that you made me moved by that image." They were angry that they'd been moved by the image. And I said, angry at being moved? Why is that? She said, well, we have enough of this in our work. Meaning, you know, she's sick of being moved and she wants to come out on a Monday night and not be moved for once. It's very, very funny, very funny. I mean, another one said, yeah, she felt like she'd been toyed with. And this comes into that area where people have an attitude towards movies that they are manipulations of their interest and their feelings. And they actually resent this manipulation. Well, I don't know. I don't know. I think movies are picked on because they are sort of a lower cultural product, maybe, for some people. I think so. So I just thought I'd say that. Movies have been accused of sentimentality, and they have been accused of manipulating our emotions. But just as us as psychotherapists should bear in mind how people use their dreams and inner imagery, and can use them in a shallow, defensive way, you know, the folk who come in and say, hey, I've had this numinous dream, and really it is quite a mask for other things they find harder to talk about. Movie experiences can be used defensively as well. But Jung warns us of this thing he calls the aestheticizing defense, the way some people relish the dramas of their dreams and active imagination experiences in the session. And just as with movies, it's possible to report such material in a poorly connected fashion or in a fashion that actually connects with where the person's really at. You know, both is true, both is true. And in themselves, aesthetic responses to movies or anything are not shallow or removed from the individual. I've read a very good book in preparation for this by a bloke called Daniel Frampton called Filmosophy. And he says, film affects us, quite rightly, directly, emotionally. How we engage with film informs how we engage with reality. The nature of aesthetic experience as a form of knowledge is as valid as rational thought. And another colleague of mine, who isn't a therapist, but you might have heard of her, because she did write a great book on Jung, on Freud and the image of the mother. Her name is Madeleine Sprengnether. She's at Minneapolis. Sprengnether. And she wrote a great book called Crying at the Movies, a film memoir, where she details 8 or 9 films that have linked into vital moments of her life. And I was going to play you a clip from Fearless, and I'll tell you what she says about it, but it's a bit too long, so I won't. And, if we've got time at the end, I think I brought it with. I don't know, I might not have done. Anyway, you know, that's where Max, played by Jeff Bridges, manages the trauma of surviving an air crash and his avoidance of death by a dissociated belief in his immortality. Now, Madeleine found her own inner invisible wounds, especially those arisen, and she always had with her, from seeing her father drown when she was 9 He was drowned trying to save her brother, who he saved, and he drowned. These reemerged when she, in adulthood, when she badly injured her arm. And during this period, she was drawn to seeing Fearless in the cinema. And during the last sequence, when Max relives his trauma, she broke down in the cinema, and she said, "I could feel waves of grief surge up from my abdomen through my chest and esophagus, flowing out of my eyes, my nose and my mouth, convulsing my body. So this is what it's like to die," I thought, echoing Max. "This is how my father felt when he knew he was drowning." Another more terrifying thought flashed through me. I wanted to go with him. And for some reason, it's always been legitimate, we might want to ponder this, to shed tears in the cinema, in a movie. Crying with joy or sadness has always been accepted in the cinema far more than at the art gallery, or the concert hall, or reading a book, even, or even in theatre. Jodie Foster, in an interview, reckons the reason she can cry in the movies is because she's not sitting in a $200 seat all dressed up. Might be something to do with that. But what also helps is, I think, is that the cinema is darker than most places. We see things. So we have a degree of privacy with our tears, while also you're hearing the others around you in the same state, but you don't have to look at each other. And this bringing together of the individual and the collective experience adds, I think, another dimension to the image, which can be healing in itself. Martin Amis, of all people, has been reported saying this. I got this from a book. He says, "Towards the end of Steven Spielberg's E.T., barely able to support my own grief and bewilderment, I turned and looked down the aisle at my fellow sufferers. Executive, black dude, Japanese businessman, punk, hippie, mother, teenage, child, each face was a mask of tears. Staggering out, I felt I'd lived out a one-year love affair in the space of 120 minutes. Something about the collective groupiness of that, I think, which is another very important thing. But let's talk about some of the other objections. What do other people say as well? Does the technology in films make them less real? How real are films? Let's talk about that. We should remember for a start, I think, that an image, wherever we perceive it, is not a passive object. All our perceptions don't arise from a neutral scanning of the world like a surveillance camera. Everything we perceive and know, whether we regard it as real or fantasy, is a construction. The human mind constructs images as representations of reality. You probably all know John Beebe, and John Beebe is the one who said, you know, we go to the cinema, you think you're watching people, you think you're watching cars, you think you're watching desert, houses, towns. You're just watching light. You're just watching light play on that screen. Images that then we make all that sense of. By convention, but also personal sense, as we've been talking about. Any such image is a product of the interaction between mind and the material world. Similarly, at the next level, the movie image is a result of a negotiation between the viewer and the screen. It is associations and amplifications generated by the film image and processed by the mind that produce the image that is not only experienced, but then also translated into language when we report it. So it sort of goes film, mental process, image, translation, word symbol or image. Or in the case of my client with the Truman Show, he goes straight to reporting the image, so we both have a reference point, rather than describing something first and going back through it. Some say the difficulty with cinema is it doesn't lead to more authenticity for individuals, but it just dictates how they should be, and only provides a simulacrum of real life. But truth is, movies have never been a simple reproduction of reality, even the way that factories, the workers leaving the factory are framed and expect it, and the camera is still and it doesn't move. That is making a reality. It's not just reproducing reality, it's also creating a reality, let alone when we watch it. Even without any CGI effects, editing and lighting, not to mention acting, all mean that what you see on screen isn't what really happened in front of the camera. Again, Daniel Frampton says, films are a cousin of reality, a second world that feeds and shapes our perception and understanding of reality. Far from giving us a real experience, I maintain that the experience of watching a film is comparable, again, to important aspects of the dream state. And coming out of a film, like coming out of some dreams, again, Frampton says, reality feels random and structureless, more chaotic. It takes time for reality to become real again. Films like dreams take us into a world apart, their own world, despite appearances, which is only thinly based on actual reality outside the cinema or in daily waking life. I think in the therapy session, film imagery, like the photograph and the dream, can be seductive. When people believe they've discovered a meaningful truth, their identification, in fact, may be revealing something that they're still seeking or missing, something they've not been able to grasp in any other way. As one analyst put it, it's not so much an actual thing as a gap that's being indicated. And any sort of movie could do this. And so we should respect everything that's brought up for indications of that sort as well. Another thing that everyone brings up about, I think it was mentioned by Aurora that, you know, dreams come from the person and movies come from where? Hollywood or France or some other filmmaker somewhere. And it leads some people to think, well, you know, this is... Yeah, yeah. And films don't.
Films, yeah.
Yeah, but there is a way, if we push this one out, that films come from human minds and films come from collective processes as well, so, you know, they come round.
What the opposition would say, I'm not gonna, is that the film comes from a collective or an unconscious that is not present in the therapeutic environment.
Mm.
So in a true analytic frame, that's where the problem comes in.
Mm.
Because you're bringing in...
It depends how you set up your analytic shot, though, doesn't it?
Yeah,
your frame, your framing.
Mm.
You see, because we're coming back to this business about the poems and the drawings and stuff like that. Now, if a patient brings, say, Van Gogh's Starry Night, well, she's not bringing Van Gogh's Starry Night. She's bringing her understanding of it and it as a vehicle for communication of something of her own. And so it matters not who made the stuff. It matters that they are selecting it and bringing it, and it has meaning for them. They're making a new meaning with everything they bring. We all are. And so in that way, I think this movie imagery business is very valid material for therapy, just like other stuff is. I think any of this material becomes a personal representation, a representation of the person's psyche in some form, in some facet. Just like when they bring a fairy tale or something like that. We don't say, oh no, they've brought that fairy tale again, heard that too many times. How corny. We say, once again, a new fairy tale, because it's a new person bringing it. And that's absolutely fair enough, isn't it? How are we doing? Yeah. We'll have a general discussion in a second, but there's one or two things that are worth pointing up now. Now, what you might have noticed at... we're still talking about this reality problem and, you know, how real are movies and should they be taken too literally and therefore should the imagery swamp us with literacy. A guy called Walter Murch talks about how films suffer from being too real. They're not really real, as we're saying, but they're very much in your face and they convince us of their reality. Movies started as a silent art form, and now sound is as intrinsic as to movies as the visual image. But following up, what do filmmakers do about the fact that films are too real? They seem to be all there, but they're not. This guy, Walter Murch, very articulate film editor, he says, other art forms like painting and literature and music and black and white silent films have built-in escape valves of ambiguity, mm-hmm. simply by virtue of their sensory incompleteness, mm-hmm. an incompleteness that engages the imagination of the viewer as compensation for what is only evoked by the artist. Mm-hmm. Now, the answer for film, and I think you might have noticed it at the end of that birth thing, is the use of sound to enable distance and disjunction for the audience. Because where you expected to have the sound of the sea, you just had her and him and the music, the cellos. And the sea came in later. And that sort of silence, that unreality, led you right into where she was at, I think. And that's what he says. By choosing carefully what to eliminate from the sound, then adding sounds, somewhat at odds, maybe, with the accompanying image, the filmmaker can open up a perceptual vacuum into which the mind of the audience must inevitably rush. Film becomes more dimensional, and the more dimensional a film is, he says, the more impact it has on the viewer. The more it seems to speak to each viewer individually, and the more the sound can become a representation of the states of mind of the central characters. I think you saw that there. Now, there's a very famous... I'll just do this clip, and then we'll finish off, and we'll finish off with the final one. Very famous example of this in The Godfather. I remember when Michael Corleone has to kill Sollozzo, you know, he has to really start being Godfather himself, because Sollozzo had ordered the shooting of Marlon Brando. He goes to the restaurant, and he has to retrieve the gun from the toilet, and I don't know if you've noticed, but the sounds there are just sounds of a train, and they come in and out, and they build and build, and it's this sound of a train when there's no train to watch or anything like that. You're just watching the intensity of Michael Corleone as he goes about this murder that actually are used to press home his emotional state. Let's have a look at that. Starts off with real sound. Gradually, you get this new sound.
What I want, what's most important to me, is that I have a guarantee. No more attempts on my father's life. What guarantees could I give you, Mike? I'm 101. I missed my chance. You think too much of me, kid. I'm not that clever. All I want is the truth. I have to go to the bathroom. Is that all right?
You better go. I frisked him. He's clean.
Okay. I've heard a lot of football.
Thank you.
See, the music doesn't come in till after that's all over. It's not done with music in that case. So I think you want a few minutes to talk, don't you? So I'll just finish off now. I won't play another one. Now, Jung reminded us that if we're not dreaming all the time, images are flowing through us all the time, every minute of the day. None of this is any good unless we consciously pay attention to them. And this is the activity of psychotherapy, to bring consciousness to bear on the images psyche is presented with. In the same way, psychotherapy can help us develop a more fully conscious and discriminating attitude towards technology in our lives. And just as it's up to us to take responsibility for the partnership between conscious and the unconscious mind, in the same way, we need to ensure our conscious awareness of technologies rather than allow them to influence human life from the shadows. It seems too obvious to point out how all our new tools of communication, cell phones and texts and emails and internet and DVDs and movies, all end up with the human user. None have any relevance without that human user. The human being is the only reason they exist, something we forget at our peril. If we're not careful, we mistake the power technology can have over us. Like the unconscious, it may seem an unknown, overwhelming other, but making meaning and conscious understanding is what characterizes the human psyche. It's up to us to stay conscious of what we're dealing with, for good or ill. It's only through the energizing power of our own minds that these tools of technology have any impact at all. So, thank you.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.